Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Last week was a great one for fans of the Aurora Borealis. The northern lights were visible far further south than normal thanks to increased solar activity. Ambient light made seeing them basically impossible in Metro Milwaukee, however, but out in the country, there were lots of sightings.
So what's responsible for the shimmering, colorful atmospheric magic? Well, our astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins us now to explain how they work.
We need two basic ingredients. We need the sun and we need the Earth's atmosphere to get northern lights. So the sun has always a trickle of particles we call solar wind, mostly electrons, that are escaping the sun. This happens all the time. But from time to time, maybe two, three times a year, we have what we call a solar flare. So a storm happens on the sun.
And that's where we see it shoot out. Like if you're looking at pictures of the sun, that's like the thing
that
shoots
right
out.
Almost like an arm that extends. Another way of thinking of it is the sun does have a magnetic field. And sometimes the magnetic field lines get stretched to the point where they break. And a whole blob of material that's following those magnetic field lines gets released.
And that's because the sun is just active.
That's right.
Yeah.
The sun will be doing that a few times a year. So that whole blob of charged particles is sniffing out the air for some kind of magnetic field. And often the good one that they're going to find is the Earth. So those particles follow now the magnetic field lines of the Earth. And that will lead them to the magnetic poles of the Earth. And they do not coincide exactly with the geographic poles of the Earth, but it's pretty close. So if you were to be flying, say, in some spacecraft around the Earth when the sun is active, you would see a circle around the two geographic poles because that's where they tend to, as I said, they follow the magnetic field lines, which is why we call them northern lights. Of course, that is our own bias because we live in the northern hemisphere. We also have southern lights, or also what's called as aurora australis.
Okay, so aurora borealis for us and
yep.
aurora australis for the southern hemisphere. Okay.
That's right. However, having said that, if you were to Google, say, pictures of northern lights, you will see many more pictures from northern locations just because the equivalent land masses of northern Siberia, northern Scandinavia, northern Canada, they just don't exist in the southern hemisphere. So there are not as many possibilities, opportunities
of actually
to take
seeing
those
it,
pictures.
Unless you're on a ship.
Unless you're a penguin.
Oh, or a penguin.
Right.
And you probably don't have a camera.
Not available.
Yeah.
So that's the first step. We get charged particles. They hit the magnetic field lines and they approach the Earth. Now, what happens? How do we get the light? How do we get the colors? Well, our atmosphere is mostly made of nitrogen and oxygen. So that charged particle carries some energy and it deposits it on, let's say, the nitrogen atom. Well, when that happens, the atom basically has, let's just remind our listeners, we have nuclei and those have protons and neutrons. And around the nuclei of the atom, we have electrons that are buzzing around. Electrons can't have just any old energy. They have allowed, like a ladder, you can imagine them, they have certain rungs that they can go to. That's it. So that means that if they get some energy, they will ignore it unless it takes them just to the right energy level. So far, so good?
Yep.
Okay. Now, the electron makes the atom excited because it's not at its ground base. It's at a higher level. So at the first opportunity, which can be as little as a millionth of a second, it goes back down to its ground base, thereby releasing that excess energy it had in the form of light.
And that's where the color comes from.
That's where the color comes from. So that's the light that we see. All these excited atoms of nitrogen and oxygen, they get back to their lower level and release that excess energy in the form of light. Now, the color scheme depends on which of the two did it hit, nitrogen or oxygen.
I was going to ask because there are different colors.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So nitrogen gives a rather broad spectrum of colors, basically from red all the way to purple, Whereas oxygen is more selective, it basically has a yellowish-green color, which is the most common color that we see for northern lights, but it also has a red color. Those are the two colors that we see only from oxygen. The yellowish-green, as I said, is the most common one, and that occurs when that electron hits the oxygen at a fairly low height from the ground, at about 60 or so miles from the ground. The red occurs at 200 miles from the ground. So if you are one of those very few lucky individuals who get to see northern lights from the space telescope, and there are videos online, you see the red hues on the top and those yellowish-green hues lower.
Wow, it's like the striations of light.
Yeah.
Oh, how exciting.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. It's even more gorgeous.
Even more gorgeous. Although, quite frankly, we really truly have spectacular pictures from all over, especially with this last outburst of the sun, from all kinds of interesting places where you see beautiful colors, but also shapes. And they change, of course, over time. So some of the video online is fast-forwarded, so you get these very quick and dramatic changes. If you were to see them in real time, they wouldn't be quite as dramatic as that, but they're still very much worthwhile.
Yes, I think of them as that shimmering and almost, you know, organic in its movement, that there's just like something alive.
It's truly like a dance.
Yeah, it really, really is. Well, solar flares are what start this whole process. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I wanted to touch on is we have a fear of them, that solar flares are going to somehow damage us or we're going to get zapped by a solar flare. How likely is that?
Well, to some extent, of course, we do care about solar flares because they do affect us. So, for example,
yeah, it's not just northern lights.
Oh,
yeah.
No. So that's the good part, right? But there are some issues that we need to be worried about. For example, sometimes they can carry enough energy to power the U.S. for 200,000 years. I mean, we don't have the way of harnessing that energy, but that's lethal if you're in space, right? So people have to protect. Satellites sometimes have to go into safe mode because otherwise they'd be damaged. And power grids can be damaged as well because there's just too much charge coming. They're not prepared to deal with that kind of charge. So we now look basically at the sun all the time with special filters so that if we need to protect people and equipment, that we can. There have been times where, you know, this is kind of funny in hindsight, but there was a solar flare that was so strong that it took out some remote control, some frequency of remote controls that basically controlled parking garage doors. And in San Francisco, I guess there was a year where basically one of these episodes, doors just opened and closed randomly. And it took them a while to figure out, why is this happening?
What happened?
Yeah. Right. A more serious potentially situation was a solar flare took out high-frequency communications on Air Force One when President Reagan was on board. And thankfully, the Cold War was thawing at that point, so they got on the phone and they said, you know, did you do anything? And they said, no, we don't know anything about this. So it turned out that that was a solar flare. So it is true that we certainly have to monitor it because we are now so much more dependent on electronics.
You were telling me before we turned on the microphones that there was one in 1848, I think you said, that was so powerful that if it had happened today, that we'd completely lose the power grid.
It would be a very serious problem because it could take down the transformers that, you know, are on major stations, and we just don't have that kind of inventory of transformers. If they were all to be damaged at the same time, we don't have the capacity to replace them right away. So that was a very, very strong event. I mean, the lights were strong enough that you could read a newspaper and as if it was broad daylight. So the hope is, the gamble is, that this isn't going to happen. Such a strong flare isn't going to happen now.
But we're monitoring it, and so we'll have some idea if something like that is about to happen.
True, but at that point, we would have 8 minutes I shouldn't say 8 minutes, because particles take longer than light, so it could take a day or two for us to hit in its full force, but we wouldn't have time to do much about it. We might be able to protect the odd one, but certainly we wouldn't be able to manufacture thousands of transformers
to replace the ones.
That's
so
right.
Let's just hope that we get a lot of Northern Lights and we don't get the other stuff.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, as always, Jean, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee, and she is our regular astronomy contributor.
Calliope Vocal Arts presents Rent beginning this weekend. We'll learn about that special organization when Lake Effect returns on WUWM.